Thank you, Ari, for inviting me to this prestigious place and to this program. In fact, I really don't have these are tomorrow's results. For me, these results are quite old. I haven't been lecturing about this topic for about the last 6 years, so they're older results of mine, but they are connected to the issue, to the topic of this program. And since I haven't been lecturing about this topic to any one of you, and to most of you it might be even new results, and the approach I've taken to those results might be interesting, so I didn't shy away from lecturing about that. The topic sounds a little bit dull, and I think a more appropriate title would have been Getting to Effective Equation of Some, at least HOPS, with soft analysis. So what I'm doing here is I would like to advocate using tools of soft analysis or functional analysis to obtain effective equations of motion in a context where people usually are using tools of hard analysis. And I will show you that there are even some advantages of using tools of soft analysis in this context. So my original motivation in looking at those problems was coming from molecular dynamics. Here you see a very simple molecule, the butane molecule. And as you see, you can frame it into surfaces, straight surfaces. And you have typically fast vibrational modes of bond lengths between those atoms or molecular groups. Then you have bond angles, which are highly vibrational. And then you have a torsion angle potential between those two planes. Okay? And this is a slower motion. And what people are interested in is, if you look at this torsion angle potential, it has two minima. One is for the so-called closed book conformation. One is for the open book conformation. And in fact, only the motion between those two conformations is of interest, and not the fast vibration in between those two situations. Okay. The question is how you can get rid of fast vibrational modes in those molecules, and at least in the limit of infinitely strong bond lengths and bond angle potentials. Here you see a simulation of some molecule, and if you go from order of magnitude in time to the next order of magnitude, you see what is really of interest is this flip-flopping between two states and not the high-frequency oscillations within each stage. And the question is, can you obtain effective equations of motion using some mathematical tools? So this was my original motivation. And so what we are given is, in a way, mathematically speaking, we have a configuration space M, which is some Riemannian manifold, say. And within that space, we have a submanifold N. And we have a potential which is strongly constraining to that submanifold. You can think of having minima along this. And this is a strong constraining potential. U of X, strongly constraining to N, which means that N is in fact the zero level set of U, and U is typically larger than zero. And then we have a Lagrangian, which is just kinetic energy. We have some weak potentials, and then we have scaled by epsilon minus to the power minus 2 this strong constraining potential, which means that we have a motion around this manifold with an
length of oscillations of order epsilon and amplitude of order epsilon. And then the limit, the motion, this is x epsilon. X epsilon will converge to some x0, and x0 will take values in the submanifold. And the question is, what is the effective equation of motion on the submanifold? And what people initially thought was that this constraining potential is just responsible for constraining to the manifold, so that the Lagrangian, the effective Lagrangian on the submanifold would be, this is epsilon, would just be kinetic energy minus the weak interaction potentials. And I will show you with an example that this cannot be true in general. So there is more in the strong constraining potential than just constraining to the submanifold. So the example I had been cooking up is the following. It's just a mass point here, x, which is attached to some wall, and we have a weak potential, a weak bond length potential, and we have a strong bond angle potential around some equilibrium manifold n at our equilibrium position phi 0. And if we take those two potentials given on the transparency, and if we start in a non-tangential direction, our initial values are non-tangentially to the constrained manifold. If we just take this as the effective equation of motion, we would get in the length variable S on the green submanifold the following equation of motion, the red one. But however, if we look at the highly oscillatory behavior here, here's the highly oscillatory behavior. If we smooth this highly oscillatory behavior, if we just take the solution and smooth it, then we get the pink one. If we draw the pink one here and compare to what the red equations are giving us, you see we are totally out of phase, and we have the wrong amplitudes. So obviously, this is not giving us the right limit equation.
That's with what value of epsilon?
Pardon me?
With what value of epsilon, just some small value?
This is 1 over 100. Yeah? 0.01. So it's not really very small, but it's small enough to get the effects. Okay? So what I will show you is how to calculate effective potentials which are shadowing this constraining potential in the right amount of energy within the normal, within the constraint manifold. And using this equation of motion, we really have obtained this limit behavior. And if we superpose this with the oscillatory behavior, we see that we then get the effective equation of motion. Okay, so the thing I would like to show you is that there is an effective potential that should be put into the business. And not so much the result itself is of interest here in this talk, but the method I have used in order to obtain this result using technology from functional analysis, from soft analysis. There's a somewhat dual point of view to this question. The dual point of view is if we think of the Lagrange-D'Alembert principle, if we have a mechanical system constrained to some submanifold n, then we know that the equations of motion are given typically by x double dot plus grad v are normal to the tangent space of this submanifold, which means that we take a Lagrangian time minus v on that submanifold. And physicists were asking themselves, how can a constraint like this be realized physically? And then they said, okay, well, there is a strong constraining potential. Okay, there is something epsilon u constraining to this potential, but the question is, under what conditions on such a constraining potential there is no effective u which would disturb the whole picture of the Lagrange-D'Alembert principle. So I could also ask, under what conditions does this effective potential does not play any role? This is the question of realization of holonomic constraints. Okay? I would like, in order to explain the technology to you, to simplify the problem to the very essence of what is going on. And this will mean that I'm not using a curved submanifold here for the purposes of the talk. I mean, the point is that in general you would use a coordinate system, a tubular neighborhood of this, and then you would use an orthogonal coordinate system, okay? Something like this. And we can think this at least locally flattened out, that we have this situation, our submanifold N is just the R-dimensional Euclidean space, and orthogonal to it we have an N-dimensional Euclidean space. Okay? This flattening out of the situation locally gives us additional terms in general which are technically which have to be dealt technically with, but the idea of the underlying ideas of the methodology become clearer if I just talk about this situation. Okay, so the equations of motion I'm studying in this situation is the second order equation with just constraining potential, no weak interaction potential. These are the Newtonian equations of motion using the constraining potential to this submanifold N. And I split x into two coordinates, y and z. And that are the fast components, and the y are the slow components, and they are sitting in Rn to R, so it's just the other way around. Okay, so this is the y-axis. Y is living in the slow manifold, and z is living in the orthogonal component. So we have oscillations around this manifold here, and the situation is order epsilon. Okay? The essential part of the constraining potential is just the Hessian. So I'm just take the quadratic part of the potential. All the other perturbations could be dealt with separately. So again, this is just for purposes of presentation. So I have a potential with a just quadratic in the z component. So n is really the zero level set of it if the h is a positive matrix. And I take H as being diagonalized, so it's just diagonal matrix with some eigenfrequency sitting on the diagonal. Okay? So what we in fact have here in the equations of motion, or at least in the Z components, are slowly coupled harmonic oscillations. Okay? So in the Z component we have lambda is the component plus the eigenfrequency, and here is the slow coupling in the Y coordinates. Okay, this is the slow coupling. And fast harmonic oscillators. Okay. I take certain initial values which are mimicking the situation, so I would like to start on the manifold. However, this some velocities pushing outwards from the manifold. So what I'm taking is y epsilon at zero, some point y star. That epsilon of zero sum is zero, so I'm exactly on the manifold. However, the velocities are pointing somewhat outwards. This is w star, and that epsilon of zero should be u star. Okay? So now let us have a look how classical Hamiltonian perturbation theory would deal with this problem. Classical perturbation theory, the idea would be you take the epsilon problem as it is given here, you transform it into a certain normal form which is easier to be dealt with. And in this case, it would be a transformation into action angle variables. Okay? So transform it into action angle variables. Still in the epsilon dependent situation. And then there is a machinery which is called averaging, Krylov-Bogoljubov averaging. And then you have an action angle at zero. And then you transform back. And this gives you effective equation of motion. However, what is the problem with this picture? The problem is that the transformation is quite involved to set up. It is already in this situation quite involved. In the curved situation, it's really a mess setting up those action angle variables. This is the first drawback of this idea. The second drawback is that you get certain denominators in front of the high frequency motion. You get small division problems, and this typically excludes certain resonances. Okay? So you have to exclude resonances in order to make this picture work. Exclude certain resonances. Small divisions. Let's have for a moment a little closer look onto this transformation into action angle variables in order to understand why they are typically used for this kind of problem. If we just look at one uncoupled harmonic oscillator with no dependence on Y, a decoupled harmonic oscillator. It should be epsilon squared that double dot plus omega squared that equals zero. This is a frequency. This is a more perturbation parameter. Then we transform it into the following system of first order, the angle variable. The time derivative of it is just the frequency. And then we have the action variable, which is constant. Theta dot is zero. This is the angle. This is the action. And they are connected to that and that dot by the following formulas. That is epsilon square root 2 theta over omega sine epsilon minus 1 phi. And the momentum is given by 2 theta omega cosine epsilon phi. Okay? And the transformation between that and zeta to phi and theta is canonical. Okay? So now we get in the coupled situation dependence on y, which means that we have dependence on y here, a dependence on y here, and this is in general not canonically anymore if we include y and the momentum for y. Okay.
Sorry, what does canonical mean here?
Canonically means that you have a simplex transformation. Okay?
Is there some non-standard simplex transformation?
Pardon me?
Is there in the background some non-standard?
Yeah, you can cure for this using generating functions in the sense of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. You can replace y prime here by some generalized momentum p, and then you get a canonically transformation back, which is, however, quite messy if you write it down. And then what you see here is that your system, in fact, does look in the following way, that phi prime becomes omega plus some O of epsilon, theta prime becomes some slow term, slow order 1 term times cosine 2 epsilon to the power minus 1 phi plus order epsilon, and then you get two further equations for the slow components. Okay, and this is accessible for the averaging procedure. However, in this slow factor in front of the harmonic oscillations that you can average, this slow factor typically has those small divisions that show up the resonances in the system. Okay? So anyhow, what you see if you follow this way, then you have to do a lot of calculations, messy calculations, and you have to exclude resonances. And this program was followed for the original question in 87 by Floris Takens. He had no resonances, and he had M, the configuration space, equals some Rm. However, the N manifold could be a general manifold. So what I'm showing you now is a completely different idea how to deal with those fast oscillations, fast coupled oscillations. So let's step some steps back and look, why is this problem non-trivial at all? The reason is, even though the Z component behaves like the following with respect to time, it's oscillating on the scale epsilon, it has amplitude epsilon, so this strongly converges to zero and shouldn't pose any problems. However, the derivative, and we are dealing with second order equations, so the derivative, the momentum is also there. The derivative goes like, it oscillates on the same scale, however, the amplitude behaves like order one. Okay? So, there is no pointwise concept of convergence of the momentum. Okay, my idea was, oh, in fact, if this is convergent to zero, strongly converges to zero in, say, C uniformly in the interval 0 to T, and I know that the derivatives are bounded, then I know that this is strong, this is weakly star converging to zero in L infinity. Okay? So, the weak star limit of it is just zero, as is a strong limit here. Okay? And the reason that this is simply working is that the linear operator of differentiation commutes with weak star convergence in L infinity, which is nothing than the shadow of the V convergence of distributions. Okay? This concept is really simple to use. For instance, it gives you a very, very straightforward proof of the so-called Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Take the following sequence of functions. This is strongly convergent to zero. Okay? So the derivatives are weakly star convergent to zero. This is just what I have written down on top. If you write this down, if you test it with L1 functions, you get the following. T, and let's phrase 1 over epsilon to be n. This is the n's Fourier coefficient of the L1 function f. And this is convergent to 0. This is the classical Riemann-Lebesgue lemma. Okay? So it's a really simple concept. To say if I have something strongly convergent to a function and the derivatives are bounded, then I know that the derivatives are weakly star convergent in L infinity to the derivative of the limit function. Okay, and this is what I try to use on those equations. And before showing you how this works, there's one charming aspect about using L infinity. L infinity is about functions which are only defined almost everywhere. So if I have some obstruction, like resonances, I can live with them as long as they're on a set of measure zero. Okay? So here I had to exclude them in general. If I use the concept of weak star convergence, I can pass through resonances as long as they are not more often than on a set of measure zero, which can be much. Okay? And I will show you in the butane molecule later on a simulation where we run through resonance. And the only way of understanding why the limit equation still works is by the methodology I I'm going to show you now. Okay, so let's erase some blackboard here. So I'm not transforming to any normal forms anymore. I'm directly heading into the Newtonian equations of motion, and I'm just looking on what energy tells me, okay? In order to see what kind of boundedness I get, what kind of extraction of subsequences using compactness results I can obtain. Okay, let's have a look at the energy of this model problem. The energy at a given level is just the kinetic energies, okay, plus the potential energy. Initially, because of my initial values, I have no potential energy, and I have just constants, no epsilon anymore, so this in fact is a constant, E star, which is calculatable from the initial values. What does this energy bound give me? It gives me constant y prime is of order 1. The prime is of order 1, as we have seen here. Okay. And certainly this gives me, by summing up, that y prime itself is order 1, and the y and z are themselves order 1, because I'm just considering a finite time interval 0 to some capital T. However, if we look at the potential more closely, it's quadratic in z, and I have epsilon to the power minus 2 in front of it, which tells me that, in fact, I can even say something better, that z is of order epsilon, which is exactly what I've already taught you on the other blackboard. Okay, and if I plug this into my equations of motion for y prime and y double prime, then I see that also the second derivative of y is bounded. And now comes compactness.
Sorry, what's the equation of motion for y component?
The equations of motion for y are epsilon. The j's component is just given by minus epsilon to the minus 2 over 2, the j's derivative of the Hessian with respect to y times z, z. Okay? And if I have z in the order of epsilon, it's all order 1. Okay? So now I can use compactness, which is here some mixture of Arcila Ascoli and Banach Alaoglu. And I can modulo the extraction of subsequences, which is not really a dramatic point here, because if I really would have to use subsequences, it means that I have a mixture of different limits. There would be a loss of uniqueness. Later on, I will show you the limit is unique, and therefore I can get rid of the extraction of subsequences. So this is just a technical point which plays no role later on. I don't need to extract subsequences. So what I get is that, in fact, y epsilon converges to some y0 in C1, and the second derivative is weakly star convergent to some second derivative of y0. Okay, this is in L infinity. This is the slow components. And the fast components, I know the following, that the...
Have you got second derivatives there?
Pardon me? I have second derivatives here. The second derivative is bounded. Therefore, I know that the first derivative is strongly convergent. Therefore, the first derivative is also strongly convergent. Okay? This is equicontinuity. If I bound the derivatives, then I know the functions themselves are strongly convergent. This is Arcelaskin. Okay, the argument I have given here with the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma is showing you that the derivative of the fast components is strong, is weakly star convergent to zero in L infinity. And since I know that Z epsilon is of the order epsilon, I know that epsilon to the power minus 1 times Z epsilon is bounded, and therefore can also extract subsequences and get that the rescaled Z component converges weakly star to some eta zero in L infinity. Okay, so this is just using boundedness of energy, what people in PDEs typically use in order to get to some candidates for the existence or limit situation, and this is used here too. So now I have to make the best from this knowledge. I have candidates for the limit, for the solution of the limit equations, but I don't know the limit equation up to now. So I should work on that. And here comes some nice point of the methodology. That you really don't have to calculate much to get some knowledge. For instance, I claim that eta zero is in fact zero. Okay? How do I do it? I look at the equations of motion for the fast components, which are just the harmonic oscillators. However, I rescale them in a way. Now I have this epsilon to the power minus 1, z epsilon here, and this lowers the power of epsilon on the left-hand side. Okay, what I'm now doing is, this is bounded, okay? But this is the derivative of something I already know goes to 0, okay? Therefore, this goes weakly star to 0. Again, the Riemann-Lebesgue argument. Here I know this is strongly convergent times something which goes to eta 0. However, this is a positive matrix. This gives you that eta 0 is 0. Okay. You don't have to go into the details of the expansions, how the fast components really look. So now comes the main persons I have to look at for the argument in order to get the effective equations of motion. These are quadratic quantities. Now I know that in fact, both of these guys here are weakly star convergent to zero. However, their quadratic expressions, which I call sigma epsilon, which is epsilon to the minus 2 zeta epsilon tensor zeta epsilon, and pi epsilon, which is just the rank band 1 matrix built from the velocities. These two things are bounded, but they are not weakly star convergent to zero. Okay? Like In this case, we know this is weakly star conversion to zero, Riemann de Beck. However, if I look at the square of this term, it now oscillates between 0 and 1. So the mean value is 1/2. And this is not 0 squared. And exactly this is the reason why I obtain effective potentials. Why the effective potentials are there? Why in the limit situation it is not just constraining to the constraint manifold. Okay, so we know this is weakly convergent to some matrix, not in general anymore rank 1 matrix, and they're in general not 0 in general. And there are the essence of what is going on. There we have the equation of motion for the slow components y on top of this blackboard. I rewrite this in a way that it is not anymore quadratic in z, but it is linear in this sigma. Okay? The j's component is now can be rewritten as 1/2 over the trace of the j's derivatives with respect to y of the Hessian times this sigma matrix, and then taking the trace. Okay, it's just the same expression rewritten in the new object, in the quadratic object, but now with respect to that object, it's linear, and then I can use the passage to the weak limits. If I take the weak limits here, I obtain the second derivative of y0 equals 1 over 2 trace of hy0 times sigma 0. Okay? And this shows you get some force. And because of this reason, there is a force which is not just telling you that it is constrained, but within the constraint manifold there is an additional force. However, the point is I need to know sigma 0 in a way. Okay, as long as I don't know sigma 0, and I don't have many hints up to now here, I know it's a square of some thing which is weakly convergent to 0, but it is in general non-zero, so what can we tell about sigma 0? This is a mic for the tape. By the way, I don't know whether I will have really time, certainly not, to speak about the quantum adiabatic theory, but in the quantum adiabatic case, it's more or less just the same, that you just use compactness and the energy bounds or probability bounds in order to extract the right subsequences. And then you are at a certain situation where you have a quadratic matrix, quadratic object, which is a matrix or an operator, a trace class operator in the quantum case which you have to identify. And for this, you have to use the second idea, which comes from classical mechanics or from quantum mechanics in the other case. And this second idea is, in both cases, called a virial theorem, which gives you certain kind of equipartitioning of energies or probabilities. And I will show you how simple this virial theorem works in the case of V-convergence, using the method of V-convergence. So the virial function of Clausius is just the square matrix, the rank 1 matrix, built from combining momentum and positions. Okay? Psi, epsilon, I will call it. And this is certainly, this is order 1, this is order epsilon, this is of order epsilon. Okay? So for that reason, I know that the derivative of this matrix with respect to time, which is times the prime plus the epsilon double prime times the epsilon. This is now weakly star convergent to zero. Okay? However, this is my pi, and then the limit I get pi zero. And using the second order equations of motion for that, I get here minus the Hessian at y0 times sigma 0. Okay? This equation I call the weak virial theorem. Yeah. The classical virial theorem tells you that the averaging of this component over long times equals zero in classical mechanics. Okay, again, simply using the same tools I've shown you, this Riemann-Lebesgue argument over and over again with the right quantities which come from classical mechanics in this case. And this tells you a lot. For instance, pi zero I know is symmetric, okay? Sigma zero is symmetric. For that reason, h, y zero, and sigma zero must commute, and so on. You learn a lot of those objects from this simple equation. Okay? So now comes the point where I look more closely into the individual components of the high frequency motion. Up to now, I've only been looking at the vectors. But now I look at individual components and see what I learned from the weak virial theorem. The classical virial theorem tells me something about equipartitioning of energy in the long scale, time scale. And here in a way, this putting epsilon to zero and looking in the fixed time scale means that with respect to the smallest time scales, you're looking on infinite. So it's in a way just the same. Okay, so the individual harmonic oscillations of the lambda component of Z are given this way. They're coupled via the slow motion. Okay, and they have individual kinetic energies. Okay, and this is, if you look at it, just the diagonal component of this pi matrix. Okay, the diagonal are giving you the individual kinetic energies. if you look at the potential energies of those harmonic oscillations, slowly modulated harmonic oscillations, then you have this. And if you look at it, this potential energy is just 1/2 over Hy epsilon times sigma epsilon, the lambda-lambda component, the diagonal component. Okay? Now I know that the weak limit of both objects is the same. This tells me the weak Fourier theorem. Okay? Both are weakly star convergent to the same function. Okay, this weakly star converges to the same as this one. Okay, and this is in the limit just 1/2 omega lambda squared sigma lambda, and this must be the same here. Okay, and sigma lambda is nothing more than the lambda-lambda component of this limit matrix sigma 0. Okay? So, given the time, I would like to shortcut a little bit because the essential arguments have been on the blackboard. The next step is to prove the adiabatic invariance of action for those harmonic oscillations. And this is done by looking at the total energy and evaluating the limit derivative of this energy in two different ways. One way is you just take the limit functions and take the time derivative, okay? Which means that you take the time derivative of 2 times this expression. This is a one way. The other way is you just take the derivatives of the left-hand sides and use the limits you have. Okay, and if you combine those two evaluations of the time derivative of the total energy in the lambda component, then you get the differential equation for sigma zero, sigma lambda. Okay, this gives you a differential equation of first order for sigma lambda, okay? And if you solve this differential equation, then you suddenly, there is a miracle happening. The solution is that this lambda-lambda component of sigma zero is given by a constant over the frequency. And this is just the constant, and this is the action. Okay? You can recognize this is the action. And that the action is constant in the limit, we have already seen from the perturbation theory argument. Okay? So it here comes in a completely different manner, by just taking two different expressions for the same guy and take the derivative with respect to time, equate, solve, and then you get this. Okay, now we can evaluate the force. This was missing. No, it's not anymore. Maybe blackboard. So the missing part was in evaluating the force. I write it down. The force was 1/2 the trace of the j's derivative of h with respect to y times sigma 0. Okay? I can rewrite this trace as 1/2 sum over all components sigma lambda times the j's derivative of omega lambda squared. And now I plug in what I have here and do the algebra, and if I do this, then I see it's the j's derivative of an effective potential, and this effective potential is just given as the sum over all adiabatic invariant actions times the time at the frequencies in Y. This is the effective potential. Okay? And those actions can be calculated from the initial values. Can be calculated from initial values, and the reason is that the convergence of the actions to those constants is in fact a strong convergence, therefore can be evaluated in the point time equals zero. Okay? So, given that effective potential, and given the knowledge that the obstructions in the general case having all those curved bound manifolds, you get additional terms of order 1 and you have to exclude certain resonances. However, those resonances have only to be excluded that they're not happening more often than almost everywhere. So occasionally you can have resonances, and in fact this happens if you look at the slow variable in the butane molecule, then it's just the torsion angle. Okay, the torsion angle is the only variable I would have like to have left in the butane. All the fast variables should be constrained to their equilibrium position. And this gives me 5 frequencies, and you see that near to the closed book configuration of the butane, there is a resonance of 2 of those frequencies. They're in fact belonging to the 2 bond angle potentials. Okay? So this resonance, however, has no implications on the limit behavior, as my theory tells, and we see this in the simulation. Here you see a comparison of the fast motion with the effective motion, and we are running at the red point through the resonance, and it has no implications whatsoever. And perturbation theory would could tell you nothing beyond that point. Okay. However, the limit theory using soft analysis can tell you that at least in the limit of infinitely strong potentials, it should be well behaved. Before closing, in the last minute, I would like to show you a further illustration of how you can understand that there should be correcting potentials if you are not starting tangentially to the constrained manifold. And this is if you look at the potential as some kind of hard potential and you have played some game of billiards. And you have non-parallel walls of this billiard, okay, and there are epsilon, there is an epsilon gap between. So the constraint manifold in the limit, so to speak, is this straight line. If you play your billiards tangentially, then there would be no constraining potential, okay? No effective potential. You're just constrained to the manifold if you're going closer and closer. However, if you're starting non-tangentially, then you see we have some kind of effective motion, okay? And this is just a mimicking what the theory is giving you. And by the way, the same mechanism works with magnetic traps, for instance, in the Alphen belt of the Earth. Okay? It's just the same, that you have a non-uniform constraining potential. And here you see as long as your frequencies and the constraining potential are really y-dependent, so this is not giving you a constant, but a really y-dependent potential, then you should see some effective behavior on the constraint manifold. And this y-dependence is here that you have non-parallel walls. Okay, with this illustration, I hope I could manage to persuade you that even soft analysis is able to tackle some non-trivial problems in dynamical systems and Hamiltonian systems. And as I've told you in passing, that I've used the same methodology to prove the quantum adiabatic theorem without gap condition. And in fact, I was the first proving the quantum adiabatic theorem without a gap condition, which is the parallel to the resonance conditions in those constraining situations. Okay, thank you for your attention.